Fly Fishing Internet Radio, your source for learning more about fly fishing in cold water, warm water, and salt water. Hello, I'm Roger Maves, your host for tonight's show. On this broadcast, we'll be featuring Joel Stewart. He'll be answering your most important questions on fly fishing adventures in Baghdad. This show will be 90 minutes in length, and we're broadcasting live over the Internet. If you'd like to ask Joel a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. And while you're there, make sure you sign up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Just fill in your name and email address on the form on our homepage, and we'll keep you informed. This broadcast is being recorded and will be available for playback on our website within 48 hours after the show ends. So if you have to leave early, you can return to our website at your convenience and listen to the broadcast at any time. The content of this broadcast is copyrighted and is the property of the Knowledge Group, Inc., doing business as Ask About Fly Fishing. Recordings or transcriptions of this program cannot be distributed or sold in any form. When we return, we'll be talking with Joel Stewart about fly fishing adventures in Baghdad. The Federation of Fly Fishers needs your support. Its conservation projects at both the national and club level are addressing critical issues of importance to fly fishers. It is involved in the Mangrove Recovery Initiative in Florida and the Trout of the Desert Southwest Initiative to help the recovery of rare native trout, the Endangered Fisheries Initiative, and is helping to prevent the introduction of harmful aquatic species to new waters with their Clean Angling Pledge. The Federation won a National Conservation Award for its efforts, and to continue this great work on behalf of fly fishers, the Federation needs to increase its membership. It needs more concerned anglers willing to join in support of such projects, and by doing so, give something back to the sport that has given so much to each of us. Join the Federation of Fly Fishers today and help support their fine work. For more information, go to the Federation website at www.fedflyfishers.org. That's www.fedflyfishers.org. Before we introduce Joel, we'd like to let you know about the great gifts we have to give away tonight. On our drawing tonight, we'll be giving away a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers and a one-year subscription to Fly Fusion magazine. So you have two chances to win tonight in our drawing. Now, if you haven't registered yet for the drawing, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and look for the link under Joel's section that says, click here to register for our drawing. Click on that link, fill out the form, and we'll announce the winners at the end of the show. We'll also be giving away a copy of Joel Stewart's book, A Fly Rod in My Sea Bag, courtesy of the Whitefish Press. And to find out more about the other books that Whitefish Press has to offer, go to www.whitefishpress.com. That's www.whitefishpress.com. Now, here's how you can win. You must be the first person to answer the question we ask at the end of the show. The question is going to be about something that Joel and I talk about during the show. And you must submit your answer along with your name and your location in the text box on our homepage. So listen closely, use your best typing skills, and hopefully you'll win that copy of Joel's book, Fly Rod in My Sea Bag. Well, tonight our guest is Joel Stewart. Joel is a self-described canned fisherman in that he fishes for anything he can, anywhere he can, any way he can, and any time he can. He will fish with any equipment, but prefers a fly rod to all others. He was born in Helena, Montana, and raised in Great Falls, Montana. He began fishing before he could walk. He started tying flies commercially at age 8 for the Great Falls Sporting Goods Company and began working full-time during summers for Mountain Bait and Tackle in Great Falls when he was 12. He also worked as an apprentice rod builder for MAW Rod Company, and as a skinner for Great Falls Taxidermy during the winter when fishing slowed down. After graduating from C.M. Russell High, he enlisted in the Navy in 1985 as a fire control technician working on the Tomahawk weapon system. After achieving his still serves on active duty as a surface warfare officer. He was assigned to the staff of Multinational Corps Iraq in Baghdad in 2005, and during that tour started the Baghdad School of Fly Fishing, which later became the Baghdad Anglers Club and School of Fly Fishing. He has circumnavigated the globe and fished on 6 continents. He calls home any place in the Navy stations his family. Presently, he's stationed in New Orleans as the executive officer for the future USS Anchorage, which will be delivered to the Navy later this summer. After the ship is commissioned in Anchorage, Alaska, next spring, he will assume command and complete the ship's entry into fleet service. He always has a fly rod in his sea bag and uses his liberty time to seek opportunities to fish new waters and catch different species wherever the world has duties taken. Well, Joel, welcome to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and I hope you got your feet on land right now.
I do, Roger, and thank you for that that great introduction. It's kind of hard to sit here and listen to all that stuff because I certainly don't feel like I'm different from anybody else who likes to get on the water and chase fish.
Yeah. Well, it started early, that's for sure. We read a little bit in your bio about your background, but why don't you kind of first, so we can get a feel for more who you are, you know, how you did grow up. You spent a lot of time in the outdoors, and how you grew up and ended up in the Navy.
Well, as you said, I was born in some of the best trout water in the world right there in north central Montana, and Missouri River ran through my hometown, and grew up in an age when I could disappear at pretty much daylight and not be home until either supper or after sunset. Nobody really worried about me, and I had the prairie from the backyard to the Canadian border was my line to roam, where I could hop on my bike and be down on the river, exploring along the riverbank, either fishing or just poking around down there as a kid exploring. So I had a free-range, wide-open childhood that allowed me to really envelop the outdoors, and my father certainly encouraged all that. I mean, he was carrying me from fishing hole to fishing hole on little creeks before I could walk, and kind of got my start that way. So for me, it's a way of life. It's the way I was raised. And in fact, I feel whole unless I'm out getting to fill that part of my life.
Well, that sounds like quite the change, though, from a life of freedom and roaming as you want to going in the Navy where you got to follow orders, don't you?
I do, and I had my rough spots. There's some people that knew me early on in my Navy career that are pretty stunned that I'm where I am at this point in my career. But I think at that point in my life, once I realized that I wasn't going to have much of a living as a professional fly fisherman, much as I kind of like Paul McLean says in A River Runs Through It, you know, I'm going to grow up and be a professional fly fisherman. I looked around and realized that wasn't going to put groceries on the table, so or get me through college, and I decided I wanted to go to college, and that's where what led me to the Navy. But, yeah, it was quite a shock, that's for sure. Also, going from small town to big city was a lot of culture shock, too.
Right, right. Well, your book that you published recently is called A Fly Rod in My Sea Bag. So do you live up to that? Do you always carry a rod with you?
I really do. It didn't start out that way at first, but what I found as I've been to the different places around the country is fishermen are a gregarious bunch, and whether we like to fish alone or not, we certainly like to have a cold beverage and relax and start talking with those who also share our passion, whether it be kind of a part-time pastime or a full-fledged, out-of-control addiction. We get together, and so I was able to make friends and meet people all over the country and have that common bond, so that got me, you know, kind of thinking I should always have one with me, and I started, you know, seeking out some pretty unique opportunities just because I had equipment with me.
Yeah, you never know what opportunities are going to present themselves. I remember when my daughter graduated from law school at the University of Miami, I'm looking at these lakes on the campus, and so I started asking some questions about these lakes and finding out there's some pretty big fish in these lakes. and I didn't bring my rod because I thought, well, what would I need my fishing rod for, you know, at my daughter's graduation? But There was a time when I should have had one in my suitcase, I'll tell you, because there was
my
opportunity.
Wife, my wife looks at me funny.
Well, and sometimes, yeah, you have to keep it in the bag, I suppose. But anyway, well, how does a sailor get deployed to Baghdad? There's not a whole lot of ocean there, is there?
There is no ocean there. what happens is anytime we have a major conflict, no single service goes to war by itself, and when we go off to fight our nation's wars, a joint, and in the case of going into Iraq, a coalition staff is put together, and so that coalition calls on people from all the supporting components to fill in and support the staff. So in the U.S., we put up that combatant commander, and he goes in there and sets up his staff and organizes, and there are branch services on there, and he puts out basically a list of jobs that have to be filled, and they get sent to the individual services who then look for candidates to fill those jobs and send them in. And those individuals are called individual augmentees, and they are augmenting that staff that we are standing up, and they go for a certain period of time. So the Navy has their fair share, just like the Army, Air Force, and Marines do as well.
When did you arrive in Baghdad?
Arrived physically in Baghdad the end of February in 2005.
Okay. And then what were your duties there, if you can talk about what you did?
Absolutely. I was assigned to the staff in the operations department, so the folks that do the planning for the general and the ground forces there in Iraq. So he has a staff of folks that do the planning, and we break it up into groups, long-term, short-term, and then immediate execution. So I was just called current operations, and I was in the current operations. My job was to push out the orders from the general to the various commands below him so that they would carry out their objectives in supporting his overall objectives for the ground forces in Iraq.
So was this like central command for the war in Iraq at that time in country?
It was. I worked on the staff of the Multinational Corps Iraq. It was a three-star general. J.R. Vines was a general that was there at the time I was there. And Major General Vines had that staff, and he was directing the movement of all ground forces in Iraq.
Okay. Now, so where did you actually work and live when you were there in Baghdad?
I was living on the what's become known as, it's kind of infamous now, but the Camp Victory complex. And it's a large military compound that we established about 7 miles west of downtown Baghdad, out near the Baghdad International Airport. And he set up headquarters in the Al-Faw Palace that was built by Saddam Hussein. And there was a giant ballroom in there that he turned into his command post. And it was a theater-style room with rows and rows of desks set up tier-style, facing down onto a large screen display showing the overall information that the general would want to see about the battle space. And we all sat in there and fought the war from behind a computer, which is a huge part of how our military works now.
So that setup, was that left over from Saddam Hussein, or
we bring that in. It was fortunate that they found a building that would house it all, but if we go to some place that does not have a facility like that palace, then that ability can be set up in temporary shelters, anything from tents to Connex boxes to temporary structures that are erected.
Mm-hmm. So this palace was where Saddam Hussein spent some of his time while he was in power then?
Absolutely. Not really, the stories varied about how much time he spent in any one of his palaces, but there was bomb damage in several areas around the palace. Whether they thought he was a target in there, I don't know. But it was certainly bombed by our forces prior to us actually taking over the compound.
So what was this palace like?
It's huge. He used it as a statement. He built palaces in celebration of his power. This particular palace was built to celebrate what he was declaring as a victory over Iran during the Iraq-Iran War in the 80s. And the Al-Faw name is a small peninsula down near the Shatt al-Arab that is right on the border, the river that separates Iraq from Iran. And it's where he used gas against Iranian troops down there. And he declared it a victory, so he built this giant palace. And it was enormous. It was three full stories with a partial four-story, each story being probably 20-foot ceiling, marble floors, marble columns, what appear to be crystal chandeliers, lots of brass work, fancy work around the palace, brass and porcelain commodes and fixtures in the toilets. A very ornate, a very elegant-looking structure.
How many rooms did it have there?
I don't remember. I know in my notes I have that written down, but off the top of my head I can't remember how many rooms it was. But it was quite a few. It was enough that the entire staff and then some for this three-star general were able to house in that and run the entire ground operations for the whole battle space out of that building.
So this was called Camp Victory, right? This area?
Yes, it was located on Camp. Uh-huh.
Now, is that a walled-in area? Was it a protected area?
It was. In fact, from what I could find out, that was what Saddam Hussein had used as a headquarters for some of his Ba'ath Party and Republican Guard folks, as well as a resort area for those that were in favor with him. They could use this area as a recreational resort. But it was completely walled in, which made it perfect for us to establish it as a military operations point. For tens of thousands of U.S. and coalition troops were on this particular base. So all the troops that are in the immediate vicinity of Baghdad were based out of here. So I'd heard numbers anywhere between 35 and 50,000 troops were working out of this one particular compound.
Wow, that must have been huge.
It is huge.
What kind of area did it cover, would you say, you know, acres?
Oh, well, again, just not being one measured off and having the actual facts, I'd heard a perimeter of 80 miles.
Oh, my gosh.
He ran around this thing. It went a long ways, I'll say that. It covered a lot of ground. And when you look at the satellite images of it, it's a pretty big area.
Mm, okay. So what was the war activity like in Baghdad when you arrived? Was it still very active over there? And was there safety at risk?
It was a hot war.
Okay.
Early on, there was not a day that several times a day you did not hear a firefight sometime. Bullets landing in and around the compound were commonplace. Mortar attacks were a weekly occurrence. Rocket and mortar attacks. Not particularly well-aimed attacks, very rudimentary launching devices, so they weren't well-aimed, but they were certainly lobbing mortars and rockets into the compound, just hoping they'd get lucky, and they did on several occasions get lucky, hit targets and kill folks and certainly cause damage to structures and various buildings around the compound.
Mm-hmm. So not the quiet open spaces of Montana, was it? Especially as far as
No, is concerned.
Yeah. Well, listen, we need to take a quick break here, Joel, but when we come back, let's talk about the fly fishing waters around those grounds, and I got going on that, so we'll be right back. Royal Gorge Anglers is a full-service fly shop on the Arkansas River in Canyon City, Colorado. They provide both walk, wade, and float fishing guide service on the Arkansas, South Platte, and several private high country ranches. They specialize in fly fishing education and work to assure that everyone taking a trip leaves being a better fly fisher. For the best service and the most fun in the Southern Rockies, visit the folks at Royal Gorge Anglers, the gateway to Southern Colorado. Located conveniently on US 50, only 45 minutes from Colorado Springs. For more information, visit their website at www.royalgorgeanglers.com. That's www.royalgorgeanglers.com. Or call them at 888-994-6743. That's 888-994-6743. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Joel Stewart about fly fishing adventures in Baghdad. If you'd like to ask Joel a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box there to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Okay, Joel, so at this point in the show, I always ask my guests, you know, what's going on in their fly fishing world, and I know you're still on active duty, but I know you can't keep your hands out of fly fishing, so what you been up to?
I have been chasing, what they call them down here in Louisiana, green trout, which everybody else, I think, in the country calls a largemouth bass. And some other warm water fish down here, including gar, and also been getting down in the marsh and chasing redfish when I can get away from work. It's a pretty busy time right now, but I find a little bit of time here and there to squeeze in and chase redfish either here in Louisiana or over in Mississippi. I've got friends over in Mississippi, so I get invited over with regularity to go chase fish over there.
And you're also involved in Project Healing Waters, right?
I am, yeah. In fact, I got to go to a fantastic two-fly event that they hold every spring as a fundraiser and was invited out to that this year. And, man, what an amazing opportunity that is. I did get to go up in native brook trout there, but also the most incredible thing in my life is working with these wounded veterans, not only from the conflicts, but, you know, from all eras. And how fly fishing is the path for them to rehabilitate or find an outlet and make life a little better for them all. And the folks that set this up have really found a niche that I think needed to be filled and is certainly growing.
Great, great. Well, I'd like to, later on at the end of the show, I'd like to talk about, you know, those efforts and how they're paying off. So we'll revisit this later on. I did get a message in from a longtime listener, Phil Panko, and he just said, Joel, from one vet to another, thank you for your service to this great country of ours. So just want to pass that on to you.
Well, thank you very much, Phil.
I know we've got a lot of currently serving folks that listen. In fact, there were a lot of people when they were stationed in Baghdad listening to our show over there or the recordings. So, you know, it's kind of a nice thing, I think, to be able to connect back here at the time. But
it is.
Yeah. Now, the grounds around this, you just described it as a huge area. I mean, that's, maybe 20 by 20 miles or something like that?
Pretty close to that, yeah.
You have a map in your book of the complex there, and you say it's not to scale, but there are, 16, maybe 30-some water features on that?
Yep.
Yeah, so that's a lot of fishing. What was the, and these were all lakes and canals that were built by man? None of them were natural, I take it?
That's correct, yeah. They were, I think originally back before Hussein started building the compounds, date orchards. Iraq was the world's second largest producer of dates prior to the first Gulf War, and a huge part of their economy behind oil. And so this area was farmed, and obviously it's the valley that's in the, the gap there between the Tigris and Euphrates River. So the cradle of civilization and where all that fertile farmland is. So I think it was, how old some of those canals are, I don't know. But certainly was an old farming, and then on top of that, Saddam Hussein built his palaces. It's a desert, so water is power. So around each palace, of course, was a large lake. I wouldn't call it a moat per se, but certainly a lake. And then the dirt scraped out to make these lakes created two mountains that were or big hills. When everything else around you is flat, these hills are pretty big, and they certainly stood out as man-made features.
So what would you say the average size of these lakes was? I guess there's some all different.
They really varied. They varied from a couple of them were really just ponds that you could probably toss a rock across to, like you can see those lakes over in the Camp Slayer area, what I call Lake USA or USA Lake and Slayer Lake were probably a mile from end to end.
Hmm.
Yes, it's some pretty big, hundreds and hundreds of acres of water.
Okay. Now, how deep were these? Were they?
I think they were pretty consistent in depth. I don't think they were any of them over maybe 6 or 7 feet since they were scraped out. And when the water was clear and you could see enough, it looked like they were fairly shallow all the way across.
Now, when I read your book, I remember there was some restriction by the command that you couldn't actually enter the water, right?
Yeah, they were keeping us out of the water.
Yeah. And what was the reason behind that? Because they didn't know what was in there?
I think it's more they didn't know what was in there and also probably tied into some force protection measure where if they told us to stay out of the water, that meant that anybody in the water was not where they were supposed to be.
Oh, I see. So somebody that was, attacking or entering the compound.
If we told all our guys to stay out of the water, somebody who was in the water was either one of our guys disobeying the rules or somebody who shouldn't have been in the water, shouldn't have been in the compound anyway.
Yeah, interesting. Well, a civilian like me doesn't know these things. that's why you guys get paid for that stuff. So. So we had lots of lakes there now. And did these lakes have kind of their own characteristics as far as fishing goes? I mean, were some...
Absolutely. Yeah, they did. Structure was always unique because structure could be everything from a collapsed portion of a building from bomb damage to Constantine wire. Definitely a structure I'm not used to fishing around. Cast off debris to sunk boats to just regular natural features that were in the lakes. And then they also had different levels of clarity. I think different amounts of water flow through them. The folks that were in charge of the management of the base worked to keep the lakes healthy, so they regulated the flow of water. So fresh water was brought in from the river and allowed to flow through the lakes and then back out the canal system and then back into the river to keep the lakes healthy. Depending on where they were in that chain, they could be very muddy to crystal clear to where you had fantastic visibility in some of them.
Okay. And as far as vegetation and so forth, different, did they have vegetation?
Yeah, what I would describe as a foil, so a thick water plant to reeds and rushes along the shoreline. each lake varied in how dense it was. They were all pretty much the same bushes, but the clearer the lake, I noticed the thicker the foil would grow in that lake.
Okay. Now, before you got deployed there and or your planning stages to go over, had you planned on fishing there? I mean, did you know about these opportunities or?
Didn't have a clue. Didn't think to, you know, get on the internet and Google, which I would have found a few folks, a few guys had posted pictures even that early on. There were other people who had discovered the fishing and had taken advantage of it, but didn't even think about that. What I was thinking when I found out I was going is I was going down to Fort Benning, Georgia for a couple of weeks of training. And so I said, well, they got bass in Georgia. And then so I threw a really cheap spin fly combo, you know, one of those you turn the reel feet around and it goes from being a spinning rod to being a fly rod. Certainly not something somebody would choose to fish with on purpose, but it was convenient for my purpose. So I threw it in with a spinning reel and a fly reel and a few flies and some simple lures and basic tackle. I mean, everything that I threw in that bag would fit in a shave kit. And just threw it in case I got a chance to use it. And I never did in Fort Benning, so it just kind of stayed in the bag until I got to Iraq.
So you got settled in there, and obviously we've got a war going on, so fishing isn't the first thing on your mind, obviously. But what...
Actually, it was pretty close.
Oh, what?
as soon as I got there and saw the water, as soon as I saw the water, the wheels started turning.
Yeah? So what made you finally decide to start fishing? Did you see fish? Did you see somebody else fishing? What got you going?
Exactly, both. To get to work into the palace, you had to walk across the causeway, about 100 yards, maybe 125 yards long. And in the corner nearest the palace, the soldiers had taken, they would go eat at the chow hall, and they would bring back bread. They got in the habit of feeding the fish in the corner. And thousands of fish would be milling around in this corner. Fish from little tiny stinging catfish that were maybe 4 to 6 inches long, giant mangar that were over 5 feet long, swimming around in there. And so you see this melee of fish down there just feeding and going crazy. And then shortly after that, I saw a guy with a fishing rod. So I said, okay, that's my sign. It's time to find a place to go fish.
And you didn't need a license, I guess, did you?
No. Actually, I asked around about that, and I got laughed at a couple of times. And basically, I was told that, yeah, there's no... No rules, no regulation, have a great time.
Yeah. So did you know, other than word of mouth, did you know much about the fish that were in these lakes, or was that kind of a...
I knew nothing. Nobody could tell me anything about the fish. They had a fish that they called Saddam bass. You're going to catch some Saddam bass. And that's all they could really tell me. I had other people tell me that there were largemouth bass and bluegill, and I looked at the water. I could see it was shallow, and when I was there in March, and it's 85 degrees in March and gets to 120 in July, August, and September, I didn't see those lakes supporting what the fish that we would normally expect to see in North America.
Uh-huh.
But I got in. I just started catching fish, and once I saw what some of these fish looked like, then I started using the internet and finding out about them and researching them. And I contacted the world's leading biologist on fish in Iraq, Dr. Brian Code out of Canada, and he helped me identify many of the fish. And then, as it turns out, on the staff as the environmental officer was a U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. He was a biologist. He was there as the environmental officer, but he was actually a fisheries biologist, and so he helped me in identifying some of the fish as well.
So, what was your approach to fishing the lake? Were you start sight fishing to particular fish, and what kind of food sources did you see there that they were feeding on?
At first, I didn't see any food sources, and in the first lake I fished, it was one of the clear ones. And I could see big carp just hanging out on the bottom. And at this time in my education, I did not know much about carp, except that they were big and they could be caught on a fly because I had done it as a teenager back in Montana. But that was all I knew. And, in fact, the fly that I first started fishing with was a fly that we used to catch carp back in Montana. And so I just kind of tied it on. It's a great attractor pattern. I went to work with it from there. And just started blind casting at first, and I started fishing the structure. Caught the first few fish is just by fishing off a structure, and unseen fish, and then I eventually figured out that there was sight fishing, but most of my the better fishing came from fishing in structure or in areas where you could see that there was a distinct difference in the water, whether it be a mud line or a water source coming in, or a wind ripple or a wind break or something like that.
So what flies did you have in your bag with you that I assume you couldn't go down to the local fly shop, so did you have any tying materials or just...
Early on, I did not have my fly tying equipment. After I started getting into it, I wrote my wife, and we had just moved, and so my stuff was still boxed up from the move, so I just had her send I knew which three boxes, and they said just mail them to me. But at first, I carry a box of just a wide variety of basic stuff, hares, ear, nymphs in several sizes, always never leave home without an elk hair caddis, never leave home without a gray wolf, a humpy, an Adams, you know, some of those basic mayfly patterns, never leave home without I grew up calling it a woolly bug, but it's a girdle bug with a hackle on it. So it's a cross between a girdle bug and a woolly worm, and it was long before I'd ever heard of a woolly bugger. So I throw some of those in, a few woolly buggers, and maybe a streamer or two. And so that basic box, I feel like I can kind of catch fish anywhere in the world, everywhere from having the small dries for the small aquatic insects to some bigger meatier flies for fish that are looking for more of a meal.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, let's take another break here. And, Joel, while I'm taking a break here, would you do me a favor and hang up and dial back in again?
Yes, sir.
And see, I'm getting a little waviness in your voice, and I'm not sure if it's your phone or if it's the connection. But while I'm doing this commercial, why don't you do that for me, and then I'll catch you on the other side, okay?
You bet.
Women's fly fishing in Alaska is owned and operated by well-known female guide Pudge Kleinkopf. Women's fly fishing offers several lodge-based fly fishing schools for women, as well as an array of small group guided trips for women and couples to some of Alaska's best-known waters for salmon, rainbow trout, Arctic grayling, and char. Pudge also leads saltwater fly fishing groups to Mexico each spring. Beginners are welcome, and equipment is provided. To learn more about fly fishing for women at www.womensflyfishing.net or call Pudge at 907-274-7113. So again, that's www.womensflyfishing.net. Or call Pudge at 907-274-7113. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We're talking with Joel Stewart about fly fishing adventures in Baghdad. If you'd like to ask Joel a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Let me just check and see if I got Joel back yet. Not yet, folks, but we'll have him here in just a second. By the way, this book of Joel's is a very interesting read, not your conventional fly fishing book at all, but certainly is an insight as to what one will do for entertainment when they're in the middle of a war, and interesting the opportunities that were there. One thing that I didn't talk to Joel about, though, was when he got there, all these lakes had different names and so forth. So he actually went around and developed names for all these different lakes and created his own chart of what was where and what the lakes were called. And some were named after ducks that were in them, or one that was by the garbage ditch, or one that was by the perfume lake, which was by a palace where the women used to stay, and it used to smell of perfume. So that's why it was called the Perfume Palace and became Perfume Lake. So all kinds of interesting names: Zoo Bay, Coot Lake, Goose Lake, Houseboat Bay, Lake USA, and on and on and on. So very interesting, and sounds like more fishing access than most of us have around our areas as well. So are you back on with me, Joel?
I am back on. Sorry about that.
Okay. I was just explaining how you had named the lakes and rattled off a bunch of the different names and so forth. So we killed a bit of time there while we were waiting for you, and now they know how the lakes got their names there. So
And the names I gave those lakes, while I named them, in the book I used, the base had different names for them. It was kind of funny, they had named them all for fish. They had various names for fish from North America, but because at the time I began writing the book and sharing about it, we still had troops over there, I did not use any of the operational names for things around that base.
Ah, so that people could identify it, yeah.
Yep.
Well, let's talk about the fish that you did catch there, and I know there were some you know were there but didn't catch as well, but what species did you find there? And then let's dig into each of them, and you can kind of give us a picture of each one. So why don't you just give us a general listing first, and then we'll dig deep on them.
You bet. So we had asp to start that list up, and then several, all the were in the same, the Cyprinidae family, which is the carps. So the common carp was certainly there, a fish that they locally called the chabot. There was Asian bighead carp, and kind of run through my list here. Asian bighead, grass carp were there. There was a stinging catfish, which was also found in the lakes. There was also a catfish that I had early on misidentified as a transplanted Wells catfish, because it looks just like a Wells catfish, but was in fact a native catfish. And then, of course, lastly would have been the giant mangar, which is the fish everybody asks the most questions about, and of course it's the most interesting fish of the whole lot.
You also had, and I believe you listed these in the carp family too, barbs and barbells?
Oh, we have the little tiny barbs, that's right, and then the barbell, which is a bigger member, yes. Got it, thank you.
Okay. So what fish did you catch most often? I mean, what are the most common ones?
Most often, day in, day out, probably caught thousands of them. With asp are, the nearest relative that we would all know is what is commonly called in North America a pike minnow, or used to be called a squaw fish. Is what most people knew him as. Looks like a skinny largemouth bass, which is why some of the sailors called them the Saddam bass. I mean, as they get a little older, they get a big kind of hook jaw on them. They don't look bass-like, but they have a large gaping mouth. They're a very predatory fish, a gulper, so they swallow their prey whole, and a very explosive predator, much like a northern pike. So they kind of lie in wait and then explode on their prey, very much like a northern pike does.
And how big do they get?
The biggest I caught was right at, you know, probably pushing 30 inches, and since they're a thin fish, I would estimate that fish was somewhere in the 5 or 6 pound range. Talked to some other folks that caught them slightly bigger than that, but I would be surprised if anybody caught anything that was much over 30 inches and 6 or 7 pounds.
Okay.
Which is a really nice fish.
Yeah, really. So now, were asp, are they native to Iraq, or are they found? You know,
that is one of the, yes, that is one of the native species that probably just came into the lake system with the river water. I don't think that they were planted there. I think they probably came in as they brought the river water in.
Okay. And you said they were predatory, so they fed a lot on minnows and so forth?
Everything. I caught them on everything from dry flies. I had one afternoon that I spent with a size 16 elk hair caddis, and I probably caught 40 fish on dry flies in the span of 2 hours, to the commonly used clousers or woolly buggers or my woolly bug to catch them on the subsurface.
So they weren't picky at all, were they?
Not at all. Their Latin name, Aspius vorax. Vorax means voracious.
Now, were these fish, you caught them both sight casting and blind casting, I take it? Or?
Yes, sight casting, blind casting. Mostly I did best. The most fun was obviously sight casting. I mean, seeing an individual fish and setting up and making the presentation. But working structure and along the edge of weed beds was probably my most productive method for them.
Mm-hmm. And what was their fight like? Did they give you a good fight?
No. They were great for the explosive take. That was kind of the end of the story for them. So it was. They were fun. They were certainly a great fish to catch. But if you were looking for that, fighting, jumping like a wild rainbow trout or something like that, they didn't have it.
They didn't have it, huh? So the hookup was the exciting part.
The hookup for them was it, yeah.
Yeah. So. Okay, then we had all these different kind of carp, but I'm assuming there were some that you caught more often than others. Which ones did you focus on?
Common carp and the chabot. Common carp, which it's funny seeing catching carp on a fly rod being all the rage here now. The golden bones and whatever names they've got for them, but fantastic fish, and I caught many of them. And then the chabot, the native, basically their version of a common carp, which in my opinion is probably one of the best fighting fish on a fly rod I've caught. And also one of the toughest fish to catch on a fly rod that I've ever gone after.
Mm-hmm.
Incredibly spooky, requires a well thought out presentation and once you set the hook, it's hang on.
So did you sharpen your carp fishing skills while you were there, and have you applied them back?
I did. I haven't done much since I got back. I keep threatening to, but it seems that every time I plan a trip for go after carp, something else comes up. But I certainly honed my skills while I was there. I picked up Brad Bifrus's, and I can't think of the other co-author, but I bought the book Carp on the Fly.
The day
I got the book, I started applying those lessons in catching fish. Also took some of the lessons that Dave Whitlock has published in articles and applied those, as well as what I had learned as a teenager back in Montana for catching carp.
Yeah, in fact, we did, early on when we started the show, we did a show with Brad Beefus on carp, and then we just did another one recently with Paul Rose out on the East Coast, cruising for carp, so people want to look for those in our archive. You'll find a couple of shows on carp fishing that should be beneficial to you. So basically, we can just assume that fishing for the common carp, you said the chabot was, I mean, common carp can be spooky and hard to hook up with by themselves, but did you feel the chabot was a bit more challenging then?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So that sounds like a real prize there. Then.
Oh, yeah, Well, when I got to go back to Iraq as part of the second go-round, when I did it as a volunteer thing, that was the one fish I really was hoping to get into again. And, just a fantastic, a lot of people understand, they fight and come out of the water. You know, a 16-inch fish on a 5-weight will have you into your backing before you know what's going on.
Now, what size did the carp, both the common and the chabot, what size did you...
Most of the common carp I caught were in the 5 to 6 pound range, not many bigger than that. And then with the chabot, they ranged anywhere from, I caught very few small ones in the, 14, 15 inch range. Most of my chabot were well over, I would say 27 or 28 inches. And the biggest one I caught was well over 20 pounds and, probably crowding well over 3 feet.
Wow. So there are some big fish in these lakes for sure.
There are some big fish there. Yep.
What then the barbel and the is it barbel or barbel?
Yep. Barbel. Yep.
Barbel, and the barbs. Those are smaller fish, I take it.
Yeah. The barbel or barbel is a European fish, just like the common carp is, that was brought in. But it's a warm water fish. So they're very much just a thinner, or not as deep, I guess, as a common carp, but a very heavy-bodied. If you weren't really into really identifying fish, you say it's a carp. But a little bit more green, and where carp tend to be that golden color, these were a bit more of a greenish-colored fish, but all the other features of a carp. And then the barbels were just like miniature carp. In fact, that's what I thought they were until I started learning to identify fish by doing ray fin counts and all that kind of stuff, and realizing that a 10-incher was an adult fish. But the barbels were a big, heavy-bodied fish, and you know, I caught some of those that were certainly up in the teens as far as weight.
And then on to the big boys, huh? The mangars.
The giant mangar, yes.
Yes. Yeah, so what did they look like? Kind of describe what they look
yeah,
like.
Yeah, locally known as a biz, B-I-S-Z, or I've seen it spelled B-I-Z-Z, which means brown fish. They actually have kind of a golden brown hue to them. I think that the best way I can describe them is they look a lot like a snook. Maybe without the darker, they do have a lateral line, but it's not quite as distinctive as a snook's. But that the way their head kind of pans out, they one thing about all the fish over there, they have what's phalangeal teeth, which means their teeth are down in their throat. And the asp and the giant mangar's teeth are a pretty wicked set of hooked fangs that are down in their throat, whereas the carp and other fish, they've got crushing, more like molars down in their throat. Mm. But anyway, so the giant mangar has a hand, you know, I could put my fist in a, if fish is about 3 feet long, it could easily hold my, you know, take my whole fist in its mouth. So a big gulping predator fish, and one of the largest freshwater fish in the world, gets to well over 6 feet in length and can weigh upwards of 200 pounds.
Well, I'm looking at this one picture in your book.
Master Sergeant Anderson?
Yeah, and he's holding it up, and the mouth, the end of the mouth is about at his breast level.
Yeah. Yep.
And then there's about 2 feet of fish still laying on the ground.
Yeah, that
one thing is
probably
as big as he is, wasn't it?
It just about is, yeah. We got some measurements from him and ran some calculations, and that fish is in the 140, 150 pound category.
Wow.
Not too shabby for a freshwater fish.
No. What a prize. That might be the biggest fish he ever catches.
he knows that, and he specifically, I mean, his story is so great, and I appreciate him for telling it to me and letting me use it, because it was an amazing story and a fantastic fish. That's a fish of a lifetime anywhere you go.
Well, tell us about fishing for the mangar then. What was that like? How did you fish for him? What did you use?
I used the same flies, and in fact, the picture you see in the book with me there as a 16 pounder, because it was always incidental. After a while, I did try and target them, but they are a cruising predator. Every one of them I found was a sight casting situation where the fish was cruising along near the shoreline, fairly high up in the water column. And often I would spot them by their big wake. I mean, these are big fish. They push a lot of water, so you'd see the big wake and could set up on them. But the first time, I didn't know what it was. Just saw a big wake and a big fish and put the fly right in front of them and got the surprise of my life when the fish looked. At the time, it looked to me like it was three and a half feet of fish. I had it on long enough to know I'd hooked into something really big before the tippet gave out. Then second encounter with them, kind of the same thing. Got long enough to hook up and realize I had something big. But that was truly a sight casting situation to where I was able to set up and present the fly and then leave the fly with the fish as my tippet broke off. And then finally the third one, which was I think the biggest one that I know was the biggest one I hooked. Again, sight fishing, got on the fish, made the presentation, hooked up on the fish. I had it on for over an hour, and finally I had to go to work. So I think I might have been able to wear him out, but the clock was ticking on me, and I had to bust him off or be an unauthorized absentee from my post, which is not a good thing in a war zone.
Oh, boy. Well, that's
I don't think
bad.
I had a good excuse either.
Yeah. So those were, it sounds like those were few and far between.
They were, yeah. I saw them in a few stories I put in the book, but I worked hard for those. But there's one soldier over there Sergeant First Class Brian Glorby, that he figured it out. He got them dialed in, and he was able to target the giant Mangar and caught over a dozen of them, anywhere from the small ones, which are, you know, 14, 15 pounds, to he got a couple that were certainly not of Master Sergeant Anderson's size, but were definitely up there in the close to 100 pounds.
Wow. Well, we did get an interesting question here from Harsh Rana in India. And he says he targets Himalayan golden masseer in India. And he said he couldn't stop. Oh, do you? He said he noticed the striking similarities between Mangar and golden masseer. And he wants to know what flies you use to target Mangar and at what depth are they usually feeding.
Yeah, when I found them, they were usually feeding in the upper foot to foot and a half of the water column, so pretty high up. The water might have been deep, but the fish were all feeding fairly high. I think they were chasing bait fish, probably small asp. They were probably chasing. I did not see any other bait fish, so I think asp were their primary targets for these big guys. Also, there were films taken of soldiers seeing these giant Mangar eat ducks, picking off ducklings swimming around the lake. One group found a pigeon that had fallen in the water, and the pigeon was thrashing around until it was swallowed whole. So I figured if you could tie a fly the size of a pigeon, you might do all right. But I use clouser minnows and woolly buggers, I found. I mean, every time I presented one of those in front of those fish, they inhaled it. So I think it was more they were on the prowl. They were the biggest thing in the water, and they were going to eat anything that was smaller than they were.
Right, right. Well, Harsh, you might be interested. We did a show with Jeff Currier. He's kind of like our adventure fly fisher on the show, and he went to India and fished for masseer. And we did a show on him, so you could search that in the archive. Might be interesting to listen to his experience with that. I think that was the show where he talked about going down the trail and seeing a tiger on the side of the trail or something. So it was very exciting.
That's adventure fly fishing.
Yeah. So. Kind of adventure you don't want to have. Well, did you, I know you talk in your book a little bit about some flies that you developed while you were there I thought were quite interesting. You want to tell the folks about some, and I don't know if Rainey's is carrying these now or not, or Umpqua, but you want to talk about your creation?
They haven't got hold of me to pick them up, but the dragonfly was fun, but man, talk about a blast. That little blue dragon I tied, well, it's actually not so little, but watching these asp come all the way out of the water to take the fly on the way down. So they jump before they got to the fly, come out of the water, and smash it on the way down. Was pretty exciting dry fly fishing. Obviously, the Elkhair caddis, you know, pretty standard, but, man, what a great fly, and the emergers and whatnot. But the bread flies were kind of fun, especially I was trying to figure out what could give me the floating endurance that I wasn't having to dry the fly out all the time or grease it up with a lot of dope, which I found made it less appealing to the fish. And that's where I got the idea of just tying a piece of packing popcorn onto it. Of course, I didn't have a lot of extensive supply materials either. So tying a little packing popcorn onto a hook, and what do you know, you got an instant bread fly. And then the baggy shrimp. As I did learn more about the water and get to explore a lot, I started realizing that there were freshwater shrimp in the lake. And so I came up with that bendback-style baggy shrimp that produced the largest fish that up to that point I'd ever caught on a fly rod. So that was one of those big shabuts that, you know, I caught a 20-pound-plus fish on a 5-weight fly rod using a size 12 shrimp fly.
So
it was kind of fun and exciting. And then the feathered butt was another great one that I tied that was kind of fun to tie, but it really was a very effective fly over there in the water.
That baggy shrimp, it got its name from because you were tying them out of plastic sandwich bags, right?
Yep. I was trying to figure out what would give me that shine and form a protective shell over the back of the carapace on the fly. And I looked over at one of the material bags on my desk, and I thought, aha, and started clipping away.
Yeah, good for you. Well, we have to take a little break here, but when we come back, we'll spend the rest of the show talking about the Baghdad Fly Fishing Club that you started there, or school, and be interested to hear your stories about that. So stick with us, folks. We'll be right back. Harper Creek Fly Fishing Company is North Carolina's premier backcountry fly fishing guide service. Located in North Carolina at the base of the Blue Ridge Mountains, they fish some of the most beautiful limestone spring creeks North Carolina has to offer. Their guide has over 15 years of professional experience, and in addition to their backcountry guide service for experienced anglers, they offer intensive, full-day instructional trips for the novice angler. So go spend a day with them in fly fishing paradise. For more information on their services, please visit www.nc-flyfishing.com, nc-flyfishing.com, or call them at 828-758-2446. That's 828-758-2446. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Joel Stewart about fly fishing adventures in Baghdad. If you'd like to ask Joel a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Okay, Joel, let's, while you were there fooling around trying to catch these fish, you started what was first known and called the Baghdad School of Fly Fishing. So tell us about this and how it got started, what prompted you to put your energy into this.
Everywhere I've been, I always try and be an ambassador of the sport. You know, you can't be in a combat zone walking around with a pistol on your hip with everybody else doing the same, and you're the only guy with a fly rod. You sort of stand out. So people started asking me, and the fishermen start talking, and we want to do all this, and I started offering, hey, you want to give it a try? And a couple of different folks asked, and it just kind of planted the idea in my head that, hey, you know, there's enough interest. Maybe people would, you know, they've got time. Maybe this would be a pastime that some of these folks would like to take up on. So I had enough interest, and I got online, and I had been corresponding with a group on a fly fishing bulletin board and asked a question. I said, hey, does anybody know where I can get some secondhand gear? I got this idea that I'd like to do. And that group, an amazing group of folks, all of a sudden got together, and they pulled together thousands of dollars worth of fishing equipment, got companies to donate stuff, send it over to us in Iraq so I could get started up. So that's how I got started with teaching it over there.
So you actually were helping folks out that already knew how to fish, but you were teaching people that had never fished that were interested as well, right?
Absolutely. Some people had fished, but they'd never fly fished. Some people had tried it a few times. They didn't like it or they didn't understand it. Some people had never fished at all in their life. And I guess I should backtrack a little bit. So before people started asking me, I mean, people found out I fished, and I took several people fishing with me. And that also helped plant the seed that, hey, maybe people would like to do this. But I had several people that caught the first fish of their life in Iraq, not necessarily always on a fly rod, but got folks started in fishing while we were over in Iraq.
And I suppose there weren't a whole lot of diversions over there for you guys and gals, so this was probably a nice one that you could be outdoors and enjoy yourself and get your mind off the war a little bit as much as you could. Huh?
Absolutely. I mean, a lot of guys got their drivers sent over, and they found places to hit golf balls and there were softball fields, and it's not real encouraging to play soccer and softball and those kinds of sports when it's hot, it's dusty, and then, you know, hot, it's 120 degrees, and not too many people want to play softball or especially basketball in that kind of heat. And then, you know, video games are just not everybody's cup of tea and not something everybody wants to do all the time. And yeah, you need that diversion, especially guys who are like me who find their center, that place where they get rejuvenated in being outdoors rather than being indoors. It was a great diversion.
Well, one thing that was interesting and somewhat disturbing, I guess, is that, you know, almost all the pictures of guys and gals you have in your book are all sporting that firearm on their side, and I think... you know, that one picture you have where they're learning to tie knots, we've got a whole line of them lined up sitting in a row, and they've all got their rifles right next to them. And I'm going, gosh, the last time I saw a rifle in fly fishing was up in Alaska where the guide was protecting us against bears. But, you know, I mean, it's a little disturbing to even think about that. And I guess you guys were at risk even when you're doing these fly fishing lessons at certain times. Yeah, never out of harm's way, right?
No, you're not, but I'll tell you, there's nothing to get your mind off of everything, like the focus and concentration it takes in fly fishing. Whether it be, I love that your shot you're talking about with the knots is one of my favorites, and it's one of my dad's favorites. My dad just loves that photo.
It
says so much. I mean, you catch your, but they're not thinking about their rifle at that moment. All they're thinking about is that crazy knot that I'm making them tie. And because it takes all their concentration and focus, and it makes them not think about everything else that's going on, the fact that they are 3,000 miles from home, their wife's missing them, you know, the kids are probably having trouble in school because dad's gone or mom's gone all the time. All that stuff is gone. They're not worried about that it's 95 degrees and it's only 7 o'clock in the morning. They're trying to tie that doggone knot that this crazy guy says you got to learn how to tie. So that focus really allows your mind to be wrapped on something else and take some of the worry off your shoulder. Even if for a few minutes, it makes a difference.
Right. DB and Escondido wrote in a couple of questions here about the equipment and so forth. He says, you received a number of donations of equipment, flies, lures, and lines. How did you handle the logistics of storing, packing, and shipping that equipment to Iraq? Did the military foot the bill shipping it over there, and was it on a military cargo plane or ship or what? How did it all get there?
It was all paid for by generous folks. All but a few were from right here. We got some folks from Canada sent some stuff in, and I had some Aussies sent some stuff in, but they paid for the shipping. I mean, you send it to the Army Post Office, which is in New York City, and it goes out to the world from there. So, if they sent it from California, they paid postage to New York City, and then it went into the military system to get it to Iraq. The folks who sent it in paid for the shipping, and it came over that way. As far as storing it, the trailer where I live looked like a tackle store. I had, you know, a gear everywhere, and then as we grew and we progressed, we actually got a space in an office in the palace where we were allowed to build a little bit of a locker and put stuff in and store it in there and farm it out. And then once in country, if a soldier at another base or a remote base wanted some stuff, we could ship it free in the military system. So it was going from base to base. We just have to pack it up and put his name on it at his base, and it was covered in the military system to ship it up to them within the country. And that's how it got up and around to the folks. But, the military system did not make any overt effort to help us out. It's just it was treated like any other piece of mail. So they got to us just like somebody sending a care package to any sailor or airman over there.
And DB also asked, as a follow-up, what happened to all that donated stuff? Was it left there for the locals to use? Was it shipped to another destination for use by military personnel, or were the personnel allowed to ship it home for their own use? And since it was dispersed all over the country, my guess would be all three things happened, he says, all of which would be a good thing. So what did happen to all that equipment?
It ended up with, so the guys who ended up closing out Iraq ended up getting it, bringing it back home. Some of it was donated to their local. They asked me, they called me and said, okay, God, what are we going to do with all this stuff? And I said, well, put it in your pack-up. It was the military retrogrades out. They had an option to pack it up and ship it back to the States. I said, you know, give it away to your local Project Healing Waters chapter, or somebody who needs it, or maybe there's a youth group that's interested in fly fishing. I said, get hold of the Boy Scouts. So all of it made its way back to the States for the most part. The conventional equipment, I think, ended up going home and is in a lot of guys' garage and still is getting used by those same soldiers today. They're using it on their local bass pond instead of a pond in Iraq.
Well, tell me a bit about how the school that you started grew and how it evolved and what it turned into, because you changed the name of it at some point too, right?
I changed the name. Yeah. So when I left, I was able to turn it over, and we established this routine of finding, as each guy's tour came to an end, finding somebody to give it to carry the torch. And we all started, and I stayed in touch and ran the website and did the coordination piece from stateside. Even managed to do it when I was deployed with NATO around the world. And so I would coordinate, and so we started talking. I said, you know, we need to do this for more than just fly fishing. It's not just about fly fishing. It's about getting guys on the water. And if we take the fly fishing out of the name or maybe put it further down, and just don't emphasize that it's fly fishing, because that scares a lot of people off.
Uh-huh.
They think that it's a bunch of elitists and that, oh, that's way too hard for me to try. So we changed it to the Baghdad Anglers Club and School of Fly Fishing. We didn't want to lose that, you know, that's how we got started. But once we changed it to Baghdad Anglers Club and changed the website and focused it more on a recreational opportunity, it got a lot more attention. And the conventional gear was in high demand. And, in fact, it was definitely what led us to running the three versions of Operation Catch Fish, which ended up being fishing tournaments we held over there. So that's how we evolved and grew. And it was to meet the need. There were folks who wanted to go fishing. They didn't always have a rod, and sometimes they only had an hour. And if they could find us on the web, they could get in touch with us, and I would link them up with the guys. And through this global network, I could have been off the coast of Africa and linking up two guys in Iraq so the guy could go fishing on Tuesday afternoon, because that's when he had time to go. He could go check out a rod and get on the water.
How many people do you think the largest that the club was? How many people do you think were involved at any one time?
It was such a loose-knit organization. I think at its core, it never had more than a couple dozen people. But
couple dozen?
Where it grew, and that was at any given time, but where it got its strength from is, I would say we had, on an average, 5 or 6 people a week coming through, getting a rod, borrowing a rod, getting on the water, and then, you know, bringing the rod back and saying, hey, man, I had a great time. The fishing tournaments we held, you know, reached out and had several thousand participants across the three tournaments.
I was going to have you tell us more about that, Operation Catch Fish. So go ahead and finish what you're saying.
Joe Mercurio, who runs a professional tarpon tournament series down in Florida, the TV personality, was approached by Admiral Fallon, who at the time was Central Command Admiral. And he said, hey, when are you going to go hold the fishing? And so Joe started doing a little research, and if you Google fishing in Iraq, you got our website. So he got in touch with me. We started talking how this could work, and CENTCOM sponsored them to come over. And so Joe, the first year, took over himself, another TV personality, an up-and-coming professional bass fisherwoman. And he toured the country, and he held some casting demonstrations, talked to soldiers, you know, took fishing to the folks. So you get these USO tours that are entertainers, but this was a tour that appealed to the fishermen. I mean, we get golf pros that go over. We get professional athletes of other sports that go over. So Joe took fishing to Iraq. So that first tournament, they had a fair turnout, and Joe had gotten hold of industry contacts and took over a bunch of fishing equipment. So that was 2008. 2009, Joe went back. A little bit bigger entourage, a few more folks did the same thing, bigger fishing tournament, better turnout, kind of applying the lessons he had learned from the first one. And then in 2010, CENTCOM said, yeah, you can come, but we don't have anybody that can escort us over. We need to find somebody in the military to serve as our official escort, and we need to get folks, you know, somebody to take us around the country, and they can't provide anybody. Well, my ship was in dry dock, so I approached my captain. I said, hey, captain, I got a chance to go do this over in Iraq, and they had the New Orleans Saints cheerleaders, a couple of them going over, as well as some more fishing personalities, and he said, so let me get this right. You're volunteering to go pay your own way to Iraq so you can escort cheerleaders on a fishing tour. And I said, that's pretty much right. So he gave me permission, and I figured out how to get to Iraq, and I got to escort him up, and that was the best tournament. I think we had over 1,000 participants. I know we set up 800 spinning rods because I sat in a steel Connex box with the other club members and assembled 800 spinning rods.
Wow.
In 120-degree heat. And then every one of those rods, if you participated in the tournament, you got to keep the rod.
Oh, wow.
So those guys, and that's how Sergeant Gorby, the tie into this, is Sergeant Gorby used that rod in that tournament to catch all those giant mangar he was catching.
Well, that sounds like quite the achievement. Now, does anything exist now like this in the military? You think this is a once-in-a-lifetime?
No, we do have one of the club members from Iraq is currently a contractor serving in Afghanistan, and he is using the contacts that he gained through the club, as well as some he's made on his own, and he has set up a Project Healing Waters branch in Afghanistan. So he is teaching fly fishing to wounded folks in Afghanistan, as there's a holding company there. They're waiting to transition back to the States. And so while these guys are sitting around with nothing on their mind except their wounds and how the heck to get out of Afghanistan, he's providing them with a bit of a distraction.
Good.
But there's nothing else that I am aware of with a program like this.
Well, we've run out of time here, but I want to kind of close things off with starting out with what Joe Dennison wrote in. He's in Fredericksburg, Virginia. So let me read what Joe said, and then you can, Joel, kind of tell us your feelings and thoughts on this. He says, Joel, we met at this year's Project Healing Waters two-fly tournament at Rose River Farms in Virginia. A great time for all. Thank you for being part of that wonderful event. As a veteran who also served in multinational corps Iraq at the Alpha Palace in Baghdad, I loved your book. You captured every facet of service there very well. My question, after you started the Baghdad School of Fly Fishing in Camp Victory, and now after returning to the U.S. and participating in Project Healing Waters, I would like to hear you compare the experiences. What are the similarities and the differences, if any, of the emotional, mental, spiritual impacts you have seen fly fishing have on servicemen deployed away from their families to that of servicemen who have also returned to resume their lives at home? And so what can you kind of give us your parting thoughts on, you know, those experiences in both places?
Absolutely. Well, it's really rewarding to see somebody, you teach them the skills and the mechanics, and then to watch them catch a fish is just a huge rewarding thing. But whether that be somebody with a disability or somebody who's just learning it for the first time. And knowing I've given somebody a skill that will stay with them for a lifetime as a as an outlet for their stress and tension and to kind of forget about the world for a minute and focus on the fly, the fish, and the water is very rewarding. But I got to say, not much compares to the emotional rewards of watching somebody who has never fished or used to be a fly fisherman, has lost an arm, a leg, sometimes both, sometimes multiple limbs, and has picked up this sport and developed a passion for it that is just amazing, and how it has changed their lives. I mean, I've heard stories of guys talking about this saved their life. They were in a dark place, and it saved their marriage. It may have even saved their life because this provided them that outlet. It's incredible. It's the most rewarding thing I've ever done. And if those listening are not involved in Project Healing Waters, I highly encourage you to find your local chapter and get in there and support these guys, because watching how our sport makes a difference in the quality of life for our wounded veterans, and not just from this conflict, but from all of them, is the best thing I've ever done in my life. And that's where 25% of the profits from the book are going to support that. I'm a huge proponent of Temple Fork Outfitters, not only because they sponsored us over in Iraq and sent great gear and are huge promoters of the sport, but because of their unwavering support for Project Healing Waters and sharing our sport everywhere, but in particular with the wounded veterans, and giving them something in their life that is unrelated to their injuries. It shows them that they can adapt and overcome and find some, because it's just about them. If they can do it on their own, they can catch that fish, and it was just them and the fish and the fly rod is the most rewarding thing I've ever done in my life. So it was great in Iraq, and it was fun, and it was great to see those guys have that outlet, but it pales in comparison to what I get to do with Project Healing Waters.
Well, tell the folks where they can go to order one of your books and hopefully contribute to this Project Healing Waters
Absolutely. It's available through Whitefish Press, and that's just www.whitefishpress.com, all one word. And they can put in the title of Fly Rod in My Sea Bag. It's listed in the catalog in there. It's available in a limited edition hardbound as well as the paperback copy of the book.
Okay, great. Well, stick with me here, Joel. We got a few more things to do before we close things out. We're going to be giving away 1 year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers, a 1 year subscription to Fly Fusion magazine, and we're going to be giving away your book, A Fly Rod in My Sea Bag, courtesy of Whitefish Press. So stick with us, folks, and we'll be giving those prizes away in just a few moments. Just as Lance Armstrong says, live strong, there's a fly fishing organization that's helping women battle cancer to fish on. It's Reeling and Healing Midwest. Reeling and Healing Midwest is a nonprofit organization that champions fly fishing retreats for women surviving and battling all types of cancer. Their mission is to introduce women to the healing powers of the sport of fly fishing and provide a one-of-a-kind experience on and off the water. This is accomplished through the elements of fly fishing, positive camaraderie, peer coaching, nature and support network, which in turn renews the spirit and hope of each participant. Reeling and Healing Midwest is in need of flies, waders, leaders, fishing equipment, and other items. To view their current wish list and to help them out and learn how you can support their retreats, visit www.reelingandhealingmidwest.org. That's reelingandhealingmidwest.org. Or call 866-237-5725. It's 866-237-5725. Just a quick reminder tonight, before you leave the website, please take a minute and give us your feedback about the show. You can find a link on our homepage in the section under tonight's show that says, what did you think of this show? Just click on that link and leave your comments. I truly appreciate it. Well, now it's time to give away a few prizes here. First thing we're going to give away is a 1 year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers. And if you didn't register for this yet, it's too late now, but be sure to do this for our next show so that you have a chance to win one of these prizes. And our winner for this 1 year membership in the Federation of Fly Fishers, which is a international organization for both fresh and salt water, is Andrew Smith in the United Kingdom, so in the UK, which is nice, Andrew, that you've been listening, and congratulations on winning that membership. For those of you that didn't win, you can find out more about the Federation of Fly Fishers by going to fedflyfishers.org. That's fedflyfishers.org. And now we'll give away a 1 year subscription to Fly Fusion magazine out of Calgary, Canada. You want to know more about their publication, you can go to flyfusionmag.com, flyfusionmag.com. And a great magazine to subscribe to and to learn from. And our winner for that is Chris Gross in North Carolina. Chris Gross, so congratulations on winning that. So now, Joel, we're going to give away that book of yours, A Fly Rod in My Sea Bag by Whitefish Press. And so I've got to pose a question here for folks, and whoever writes in first with the correct answer will win that prize. So I'm going to clear my queue here, and let's see here. Another thank you from Mike Marino, Sutterton, Pennsylvania, thanking you for your service and what you did to make things better for the guys and gals that served over there. So just want to pass that on.
Thank you, Mike.
So we'll make it easy tonight. Name three of the fish that Joel caught over there in Camp Victory. So name three of the fish, and you got yourself Joel's book here, Fly Rod in My Sea Bag. So, Joel, I'm waiting for some answers here. Fly fishermen might be good fly tires, but they're not necessarily the best typists or the fastest. So
that, and I'll be interesting to see the spellings.
Well, we're not going to count spelling, are we, Joel?
I don't think we should, because I think I had a heck of a time with that as I was writing the book.
Okay, well, here's the first answer. We've got mangar, that's a good one, Asian catfish, and carp. What do you think?
It was not an Asian catfish. It was a native catfish, and then, of course, the common carp.
Okay, you want to look for a closer match here? Because the Asian catfish is pretty... Okay, let's... sorry, Laura. Let's see what... No, Phil, you got to be more definitive than that. You said common grass mangar. That's not it. Okay, how about this one? Mangar, Asp, and Barvel.
That's it. That's the exact one.
So that's DB and Escondido who sent in those questions about the equipment. So
fantastic.
So DB, you got that book. DB, you're going to have to send me your name, your address, and I've got your email address here, but your shipping address so that we can get this book sent out to you. So send that either in the same box you just answered the question or send it to info@askaboutflyfishing.com. That's info@askaboutflyfishing.com, and we'll get that book sent right out to you. So congratulations.
I live in San Diego, so sometime I can link up with DB and autograph that book for him.
Oh, there you go, DB. So that'd be great opportunity for you guys to meet, maybe fish together. So, well, Joel, thanks you so much for being on the show with us. It was a pleasure to have you and share your experiences. And as others have done, thank you for your service to our country, which you are still doing, and we appreciate that along with everybody else that's doing their part in that way. But thanks for being on the show.
You bet. Thank you, Roger. I really appreciate it. Have a great evening.
Great. Well, hopefully, folks, you've found our archive out on our website. If you haven't, there are a couple of links on it on our homepage and links at the bottom of every page to the archive. Check it out. We've got about 150 shows out there right now. You can search it by keyword phrases like trout, tarpon, you know, Madison River, Bighorn River, whatever, and you'll find shows on those topics. So go ahead and explore it, and you'll be pleasantly surprised at what you discover. Our next broadcast will be on August 8th, 7 p.m. Mountain Time, 9 p.m. Eastern Time. And on that show, we'll interview Michael Mastrolangelo, and our topic for the show will be fly fishing the Bighorn River. Michael is a professional guide on the Bighorn River in Montana, considered one of the finest rivers in the world for fly fishing. So listen in to hear Michael share his secrets about fly fishing this incredible fishery. We'd like to thank the Federation of Fly Fishers, Fly Fusion Magazine, Royal Gorge Anglers, Women's Fly Fishing in Alaska, and Harper Creek Fly Fishing Company for sponsoring our show tonight. If you think your company would benefit from sponsoring one of our shows, give us a call at 1-800-985-1673, extension 8. That's 1-800-985-1673, extension 8. We'll be happy to explain the options available to you. Don't forget to visit our website at askaboutflyfishing.com and make sure you're signed up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Thanks for listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We hope you enjoyed the show. That's it. Good night, everyone, and good fishing.